Yeah, with that background, you may wonder how I got into the Second Amendment, and I must say it's been very exciting to be able to actually apply English history and colonial American history to a burning constitutional issue, and one that we hope will finally be resolved with wisdom by the Supreme Court. As most of you know, I'm sure, the Second Amendment has fallen on hard times, and there's a great deal of confusion, not about the scope of it so much as about the original intent of it and the actual meaning. It's probably the only right in the Bill of Rights where that's the case, where it's the actual meaning that is at issue rather than how it ought to be applied. Judge Alex Kosinski, who's, I guess, not just mine, but a favorite of many, who sits on the Ninth Circuit, was chastising his fellow justices for treating the Second Amendment in a very cursory fashion and claiming that it didn't really include any individual right. And he said, "It's wrong to use some constitutional provisions as springboards for major social change while treating others like senile relatives to be cooped up in a nursing home until they quit annoying us." He also referred to the Second Amendment as being treated like a crumpled gum wrapper. When you are done, you just toss it away. For many years after the Second Amendment was ratified, there was really no controversy that it included and was focused on an individual right. And it's just really been the 20th century, and particularly the last part of it, where there's been a controversy. The beginning of the early in the 20th century, there were concerns in about immigrants coming into this country, flooding the Northeast, and New York passed its Sullivan Act in 1911 as a way of sort of trying to ensure that this rabble did not have a right to be armed, or to curtail that by insisting on registration. And in the South, there were efforts to keep African Americans from being armed, so it was sort of fears of the wrong people being armed that caused them to start limiting it. I'm just going to briefly refer to some of the, I think in some cases, rather ingenious theories of why the Second Amendment does not mean what it says, that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. I suspect that this audience is probably familiar with some and maybe all of them, but however, some of them I think are rather humorous, they really have been seriously argued. The main one, of course, is the insistence that the Second Amendment is really only conferring a right of states to have an armed militia, and it's only members of that militia that have a right to be armed. So it's either a right for the states to have militia, which presumably, if you read the Constitution, they already have, or can you hear me? Oh, I either need to get taller. This has got to get smaller. There we go. Or that if you were a militia member in conjunction with your militia service, you are entitled to have a weapon. It would be an odd militia if you couldn't. And in this sense, it's referred to as a collective right, not an individual right. So no individual has that right, but somehow the collective has the right. And I must say, you know, thinking about constitutional rights, it's hard to see how anything can be a collective right and not be an individual right. You have a right to assemble, but each of you has no individual right to assemble. But be that as it may, sometimes it's referred to, if they admit that there's an individual right, people say, well, yes, there was originally meant to be an individual right, but it's an anachronism. We have police now. We don't need any individual right. The expression to keep and bear arms is shortened to bear arms, and bear is assumed to be only used in a military context, not to keep, to carry something around with you. And the word keep is quietly forgotten or linked inexorably to bear, so it's keep and bear, and the keep part is somehow meant to be excised. Then one of my favorite is the Bogus theory, by Carl Bogus's theory of why it's not an individual right. And Carl Bogus's theory is that really it was a plot of the Southerners that the Northerners cooperated in order to keep the slaves down. Of course, there were slaves in the North at the same time, but anyway, I love to call it the bogus theory, and until he changes his mind, I will continue to do that. There's also the comma theory. Different versions of the Second Amendment have different amounts of commas, but the comma theory, which has been seriously argued in legal briefs, is that since the right of the people to keep and bear arms is set off by commas, it can be eliminated. And presumably, if you went through the Constitution and eliminated every phrase set off by commas, it would be a very interesting document that you would end up with. There's also the idea that it only protects 18th century weapons, as if the right to freedom of speech wouldn't, you know, affect any modern technology. It was only, you know, actual speaking without microphone even back in the 18th century. Well, these are some of the theories, and by the 1975, the American Bar Association decided to have a committee study the meaning of this Second Amendment, and confused by all of this, they were so befuddled that they did agree that there was less agreement and more misinformation and less understanding of the right of citizens to keep and bear arms than on any other current controversial issue. And they came to the conclusion that, of course, the crux of the controversy was the construction of the Second Amendment to the Constitution. They concluded, quote, "It is doubtful the Founding Fathers had any intent in mind with regard to the meaning of this amendment." And here's this group of learned lawyers, and they felt that the Founders had no intent. Presumably, they just needed something between the First Amendment and the Third Amendment, and so they came up with this idea. But unfortunately, I think in law schools, a lot of the of some of these theories, particularly the collective rights theory, has been taught for many years. Lawrence Tribe's great textbook on the American constitutional law in the first edition, 1979, had reduced the Second Amendment literally to a footnote. I mean, if you look through it, it is just a footnote. 10 years later, 1989, when he came out with the next edition, it graduated to have a couple paragraphs. And I must say, happy to say that 1999, his latest edition, there were 10 pages allotted to it, and he, at that point, decided that it actually was an individual right. My own work has been, as David said, on the English right and the background, and I'm going to just briefly go through that. I want to leave time for Steve Halbrook to speak and for you to have a chance to ask questions. But I was very pleased that in the appeals court's decision in the Heller case here in Washington, D.C., that they pointed out that the Second Amendment did not create a right, but in fact preserved a right. And I think that that was clear from the research that I've done. The English right actually started as a duty rather than a right. People actually had a duty to protect themselves, protect their family, and protect their neighbors. If you didn't carry out that duty, you could be fined or punished. You had a duty to keep the peace. And in fact, protecting yourself was a way of keeping the king's peace. You also had a duty to answer the hue and cry when somebody committed a crime, and you had to appear with your weapons and follow the sheriff and chase this person from town to town, as they said, and county to county in order to get them. People took turns standing watch. And also, you had some people had a duty, those who were within certain ages, to be a part of a militia and train with the weapon of the day. First it was the longbow, and then reluctantly they gave up the longbow and switched to muskets. But all of the time it was a duty and not really a right, or at least it was never referred to as a right. You were obliged to keep certain weapons. You were obliged to use them to keep the peace and protect yourself. And it was not until after the English Civil War, where the Parliament and King were fighting each other, where people were being forcibly disarmed, particularly the King was fond of summoning the militia and their best weapons to appear, and then he took their best weapons and sent them home. So after this happened a few times, the militia members admitted that when the king ordered them to appear, they were going to appear, but their arms were going to stay at home, so they'd have them to go back to. But there was a lot of anxiety about being disarmed. And when the monarchy returned to power, they began to use a sort of select militia to disarm their opponents. And by 1688-89, the time of the English Glorious Revolution, when William and Mary come in, a Bill of Rights is drafted to affirm English rights. And all of these are called ancient and indubitable, but one of them is the right to be armed. And it was not, so far as I could see, an ancient and indubitable right, but they were sure that they wanted it to be an ancient and indubitable right. It was restricted in a way that the American right was not. It was restricted to Protestants, who were about 90% of the population, simply because Catholics had been ordered by the Pope to overthrow the Protestant monarchy at the first opportunity. So there was always a worry that if a Catholic, it was okay if he had guns to protect himself, but if he was amassing weapons, then there was suspicion. So there were certain liabilities about Catholics. The Protestants could have arms for their defense, their own defense. Never says anything about a militia. They could have arms for their defense suitable to their condition and as allowed by law. So it left some room for legislation, but it was an individual right. I must say that the American scholars looking at this right have tried to read back into it as a way of dismissing it, the American issue. And so we have Roy Wetherup writing that the English guarantee that the subjects which are Protestant may have arms for their defense really means Protestant members of the militia might keep and bear arms in accordance with their militia duties for the defense of the realm. So he kind of, the English never mentioned militia, but militia was sort of read back by Americans into it. By the time of the transplantation to this country of colonies, a lot of the English tradition got copied here. So there was a militia here, there were obligations to be armed, and sometimes obligations to carry your weapons with you, an obligation to protect yourself and your neighbors. So to the extent possible, a lot of these old traditions were sort of reinstated in this country. When the American Revolution occurred, the British right to be armed was one of those rights that they fought for as English subjects. In England at the time, there were more and more cases and comments that made it very clear that even though the English right to be armed was limited to Protestants and as allowed by law, that it actually did affect most individuals. Blackstone, whose first volume of his famous commentaries on the law of England was published in 1765, 10 years before the American Revolution, and was an instant bestseller. And he referred to the three great and primary rights of personal security, personal liberty, and private property. And the right for the subjects to have arms was what he listed as one of the auxiliary rights. In particular, it was a right to be able to protect your other rights if need be. Should the government ever tyrannize or take your other liberties away, then the citizens would be able to protect themselves. Two other quotations that I'd just like to impose upon you, I guess. That'll be very brief. That I think make it clear what that right meant that was inherited by the founders of this country. In 1790, the Recorder of London, who was the legal advisor for the City of London, was asked his opinion because there had been a series of really serious riots. They'd had about 3 days of crowds rioting and even breaking into the Parliament building. So the question was, what were the right of the subjects to be armed? And this is his answer. The right of His Majesty's Protestant subjects to have arms for their own defense and to use them for lawful purposes is most clear and undeniable. It seems indeed to be considered by the ancient laws of this kingdom not only as a right, but as a duty. He's kind of got it reversed. It was a duty and then a right, but that was fine. It was not only as a right, but as a duty. For all the subjects of the realm who are able to bear arms are bound to be ready at all times to assist the sheriff and other civil magistrates in the execution of the laws and preservation of the public peace. And that right, which every Protestant most unquestionably possesses individually, may and in many cases must be exercised collectively is likewise a point I conceive to be most clearly established by the authority of judicial decisions and the ancient acts of Parliament, as well as by reason and common sense. A few years later, there was some armed insurrections in 1820, and the case at that point, Rex v. Dewhurst, and the judge in that case actually said specifically, are arms suitable to the condition of the people in the ordinary class of life, and are they allowed by law? So this was the aspect of the English right that there were questions about. Are they suitable to ordinary people, and are they allowed by law? His answer was, a man has a clear right to arms to protect himself in his house. A man has a clear right to protect himself when he is going singly or in a small party upon the road where he is traveling or going for the ordinary purposes of business. And as I said, the Americans sort of inherited what was at that time in England a very clear right. Finally, I would like to cite defense counsel from this Rex v. Dewhurst case. He's talking about the right to assemble because one of the issues in that case was that people came to an assembly armed. So that there's a question, you can have weapons as an individual and carry them for protection, but do you have a right to come armed? And the defense counsel is in this case is referring to the right to assemble, but I think it fits very well the right to be armed, and particularly the American case. He says, gentlemen, many men would suppose it would be better if it had been no part of our Constitution. I'm sure that there are a lot of people who feel that it shouldn't be a part of the American Constitution. He says, I can very readily believe that. But our lot has been cast in a land where it has pleased our ancestors for now two centuries to go through a series of struggles and controversies of danger and of death for the acquisition of freedom. Our ancestors were pleased rather to enjoy a condition of perilous freedom than a state of abject tranquility in the condition of slaves. If with that glorious condition there be some qualifications and some deduction, then I say only this: no institution is perfect, no condition absolute and without its fault. And if there be in the realm of England, we can say America, and the practice of our ancestors, some hazard, difficulty, and danger, so I say also is there an inheritance of glory. And I'm hoping that the Supreme Court will have the wisdom to affirm that inheritance. Thank you.